Welcome to the Lisa Fisher Said podcast. I'm Lisa Fisher, a longtime broadcaster and journalist, and now a health coach based in Arkansas who's been in front of a microphone or a camera since the 1980s. I think of myself as the queen of Arkansas media. I started this podcast in 2020 to help you live a better life. In fact, I hope this podcast is the best 45 minutes of your week. Today, we're talking about your interest or quest for sobriety with the founder of Functional Sobriety. She's Dr. Brooke Scheller. She's an expert in sober nutrition and the author of a new book you need to read. You'll get to meet her right after this. Well, look what I just found on the Akel's Carpet One website. So you have to keep up with these things. These people are always doing something that helps you, the customer. And that is the Spring Home Makeover Sales Event. It's 36 months interest-free financing and up to 50% off store-wide. They'll pay your sales tax. Do I need to repeat that? You can start your project today. It says right there if you want to click on the link. Of course, I'm telling you about a website. I'm also telling you about the stores. It's Akel's Carpet One. Those of you in Central Arkansas know three locations. And these are the people where they beat the big box store prices. Yeah, think about that just a moment. You will not get a better value. You will not get a better deal. And you won't get the good customer service. They answer their phone here. They have people that this is all they do at Akel's Carpet One. Whether you're at the Mall Mel store that's been totally redone, the Sherwood store has had a facelift, and West Little Rock. So they're keeping up with you, the customer, by making it easy to shop. The selection's there. The luxury vinyl plank, it's all the rage. But so is saving money the rage. And they do that for you every day at akelscarpet1.com. Go to their website. Go by and see them. You know, being a friend of Lisa Fisher, of course, always helps. But you'll love shopping there. It's akelscarpet1.com. I love to tell my friends and followers of my social media about the beauty and the mystique of Marlsgate. Marlsgate.com is the website. Those of us in Central Arkansas know about it. It's 15 minutes from downtown Little Rock, over 1,100 acres that has stood the test of time, this property, since the 1850s. Just the third owners, Martha Ellen and Beau Talbot, have taken it and put their own spin on it. Since 2017, that's when the Talbots thought, okay, let's have another project. They do a lot of things. They're the people behind Scott Station there. They're the people behind the shops at Scott. They do a lot to invest in that community. And one thing is open up the doors of Marlsgate to you and me on Thursdays. So if you're in Central Arkansas, even if you're outside of the area and want to just come explore the property with the pecan orchards, and you can just see the old mixed in with the new, and it is absolutely breathtaking. They have tenderly loved it, and it's very impressive. It's where maybe, you know, you've been to a wedding there, or I host cooking classes there, or I mean, just so many different things. It is their private and personal home that they've opened, but you can also take advantage of some of the different opportunities they have given the community to enjoy it. Find out more by going to their website, marlsgate.com.
She won most talkative in high school, and she has been running her mouth ever since. Welcome to the Lisa Fisher Said podcast with your host, Lisa Fisher.
Okay, functional sobriety is what your specialty is. You got to tell me more about this. Like, because your PhD or doctorate, right? Or doctorate you have in clinical nutrition, but somehow you wove sobriety into it. Tell me more.
Yeah. So first of all, thank you so much for having me on the podcast. I'm thrilled to be here. And my experience, my background is in nutrition. I'm a doctor of clinical nutrition. I've been practicing nutrition for about 15 years. And I wasn't always an expert in sobriety. In fact, I used to be a pretty heavy drinker. So if you read my new book, How to Eat to Change How You Drink, you'll hear a little bit about my story and how I was a pretty heavy drinker. And like many of us and many of the people who are interested in health and wellness, I think that we like to imagine that we can live in a world where we can drink alcohol and indulge and imbibe, but also be healthy. And that was something that I kind of felt like I was always on a mission to prove. And it wasn't until my own experience in eliminating alcohol from my life that I realized that alcohol is essentially, it's a macronutrient. We look at it similarly as we do to things like protein and carbs and fat, because it's the only other nutrient, quote unquote, that provides calories. And so when we think about it in that way, and when we think about it from a nutrition perspective, we can have a really different approach as to how we support the body with alcohol elimination, how we think about the ways that alcohol affects our gut, our brain, our nutrient levels, and all of these other areas of the body. So after kind of going through my own experience in sobriety, realizing that we're not talking about alcohol as part of the health and wellness conversation and recognizing this opportunity. So it really kind of took off once the book started. I started working on the book, and it's just been something that people have really loved to learn about and understand more about how it's impacting their life.
Let's go back 15 years when the wine producers had a really good PR company that helped them have some, as it always is, research is always, I mean, follow the money. The research was backed by the grape growers of California, or whatever it was, and told us all. I mean, there were grandmothers in the nursing home telling their children, you got to go get me a bottle of the red blend because it's going to help my heart. Let's talk about the fallacy in that argument. And what really the truth is about what alcohol does to our body.
Yeah, so you're right. We kind of take, and this is what the media loves to do, right? Is we love to just take this like one piece of information from a study and headline it and make it this kind of big, and it really changed and transformed the way that people thought about alcohol.
Absolutely.
And is something that we're having now that we have more research that's really showing the truth of how alcohol affects us, we're having to backpedal a little bit and say, we may have told you that, but let's talk about what's truly happening in the body. And so a lot of that early research too comes from the research around the Mediterranean diet and the people living in the quote unquote blue zones of the world that have a really long lifespan and consume wine. But also the people in these regions also eat a diet very low in processed foods. They eat a lot of fresh produce, a lot of
wild caught fish. They get sunlight every day. They have good
sunlight,
community, right?
Community. They have very low stress. So there's a lot of elements playing into why that lifespan may be longer. And over the last couple of years, what we've really been seeing in the scientific literature is more studies that are showing longer term effects of alcohol on the body, looking at larger sample sizes, larger groups. And there was a few studies that came out in 2022 that actually started to go against some of the previous research that we had around the benefits of wine, and actually showed that that alcohol at any level is actually negatively affecting cardiovascular health.
Wow.
And it's actually increasing cardiovascular risk.
Wow.
Negatively, right? So it's increasing blood pressure, it's potentially increasing cholesterol. And again, we're looking at it in the complexity of the American diet, the American lifestyle, where stress is very high. We're eating a lot of processed foods. You know, even if we're exercising, and there's also some studies that show that people who exercise have higher levels of alcohol intake because they're using exercise as a way to kind of combat that.
They're justifying
it,
for
sure. And I think we can all relate to that, right? We can all relate to, maybe I had a weekend where I didn't eat so great, or I overdid it with alcohol. Let me get back on my nutrition plan. Let me over-exercise to kind of undo the damage that I've done. And so now we're really finding, and people hate to hear it, because I think we loved the idea that alcohol maybe provided health benefit, even if we were over consuming what that recommendation, that single glass of wine might have been, it still provided this health halo, right? Like we had this kind of illusion that maybe we weren't doing something that harmful for our health.
Because it's the resveratrol, I hope I'm saying that right, in the red wine, right? So red wine sales through the roof, again, with every little church lady group in the country playing Mahjong, they're going, we've got to get the, you know, we used to have punch, we've got to have red wine. So red wine, did they find benefits also in white wine? in that early research?
There are still antioxidant benefits because the resveratrol itself comes from the grapes. So it's not actually the wine. It's okay. The grape.
Sorry, which I fell is for why, hook, line, and sinker.
But exactly, you're proving the point exactly, which is that you don't need to be consuming wine in order to get antioxidants. So grapes, some of the berries, peanuts, dark chocolate has resveratrol. Oh, yeah. So we can get it through other foods. We don't have to be consuming the wine, but it did create this health halo again that you almost need to be consuming wine if you want to get those health benefits.
Okay. Doctors were sending home to their patients a prescription, air quotes, because that's how I heard this first story like 20 years ago, mm-hmm. total teetotaler in the South. And he said, yeah, dad's drinking red wine every night. And we went, what? And he goes, his cardiologist, whoever he saw, he probably didn't have a surgeon at that point, said he needed a glass of red wine every night for his heart. So are doctors now backtracking, going, okay, not so fast. You can have some grapes and some dark chocolate and everybody's happy.
Well, I think we're still early on in the movement. Not everyone has adopted this idea or this, I really believe the truth around the impacts of alcohol on the body. And, you know, while there was controversy about the wine having benefits for cardiovascular health, there was always this underlying standard that if people didn't drink, they shouldn't start drinking. Like if they weren't having wine, they shouldn't start introducing it just for the health benefits, right? Because there are other effects. Now, one of the things that we know for sure, and there really hasn't ever been controversy over, is that alcohol increases risk for certain cancers, breast cancer being one of the big ones.
We've just been hearing that, I feel like, Dr. Brooke, in the last year or two, for, you know, the first 100 years of my life, never heard it. And maybe it's because I'm in the health space, so my algorithm is leaning toward that. Yep. But now I'm seeing that all the time.
Yeah. And it's something that has been known, but again, maybe not something that we've kind of publicized very widely. That again, there's a lot of media, there's a lot of money, there's a lot of stuff going on in the background that's kind of painting this pretty picture around alcohol. But there's a huge conversation now happening globally. I was part of a summit for the World Health Organization out of Europe a few months ago, and they're really tackling this conversation similar to tobacco. And I actually heard on this seminar that I was attending that the research on the health effects of alcohol came out only 2 years after the research on the health effects of tobacco. Which means if you look at how far we've come with tobacco in terms of regulating, you know, where you can smoke, ensuring that there's warning labels on cigarettes, creating more public awareness around the health effects of tobacco. We haven't done any of that with alcohol. And here's the issue is that there are a lot of, cancer is just one of the many risks. And a lot of what I talk about in the book gets into some of the other areas that people are struggling with, like their digestive health. Alcohol affects the gut and the gut microbiome. It affects our hormones for both men and women. The way that it affects hormones is also part of the reason why it affects or increases risk for hormone-specific cancers like breast cancer. It affects things like our nutrient levels and, you know, how many of us are taking multivitamins or supplements to try to optimize our nutrition status. Well, alcohol is directly lowering most of our nutrient levels, right? So it's creating and wreaking a lot of havoc in the background. And, you know, the reason why I love talking about this and bringing this to light is because so many of us are struggling with our health. We're struggling with anxiety. We're struggling with mood disorders. We're struggling with fatigue. Again, hormone imbalances. And not really until now have we talked about the fact that alcohol might be underlying some of that stuff. And usually what we've done is we've gone to alcohol to help get us through those challenges, right, when it actually could be making those things worse.
Well, that is an eye-opening statement for, I mean, COVID obviously was the pandemic of wine. I mean, it was almost a famous meme. It's almost a caricature. People would get together on a cul-de-sac 6 feet apart, which Fauci just admitted this week. There was no science to that. another story. That's another conversation. But people were wearing masks 6 feet apart, which we know that we can argue masks, drinking wine. Do you see all the ironies in that one image? None of it made sense, but it shows how gullible we are to any message that might make, I can drink more alcohol? Okay, I will with my mask on 6 feet apart. Now I'd like to see if there's a diagnosis in that. Not to say to reward myself. I'm just saying the cause and effect. Was there a cause and effect? I was just reading yesterday, there's been an increase in cancers. We're in 2024 recording this. So I wonder if that's in relation to the pandemic. What do you think about that on a nutrition scale?
Yeah, we saw some pretty staggering statistics around alcohol consumption during and just kind of from 2020, but also into 2021, and especially in women. And a lot of it was stress related, right? Like we were outside of our element. We were working from home. I mean, women especially are maybe now parenting from home or having to do school at home with the kids while working, while having everybody, you know, home and in the same environment. So there was some pretty staggering statistics around the increases, especially in women with drinking during the pandemic. And I think that has fueled a lot of the movement that we're in now towards sober curious, toward people being more interested in cutting back or reducing or eliminating. There's also a booming non-alcoholic beverage space, which is happening right now. Lots of mocktails, lots of non-alcoholic wines, non-alcoholic beers. And these products have really come a long way from the O'Doul's of the past, where we used to, that was the only one single option.
Right.
There was one option if you wanted to not drink. Well, now you could go to a restaurant and there's a mocktail menu, and maybe they have a couple of non-alcoholic beers or wines. And so we've really come a long way in supporting people in changing alcohol behaviors. But I really do believe that a lot of that is carryover from people increasing their intake during the pandemic.
Okay, let's talk about your story. You know, it's part of your book, and I'll put all that in the show notes, how to change how you drink alcohol, how you drink, and we're talking about alcohol, obviously. So tell me your story.
Yeah, so I was a heavy drinker since I was young. I was a teenager. I think a lot of us start in those teen years, you know, the rebellious behavior. But I experienced some trauma in my late teen years with my family, and looking back, realize how much that influenced a lot of my alcohol use in my late teens, picking up to becoming a pretty frequent, maybe 4 or 5 days a week drinker by the time I was in my early 20s, and continued that behavior throughout my 20s and early 30s, all the while becoming an expert in health and nutrition and going through multiple degree programs, working in wellness centers, working with people. And, you know, the interesting thing about alcohol is you can always find the people that are the drinkers, right? And so whether you're in a circle of people who are healthy or not, there's people there who are drinking too. In fact, you know, I've attended many a conference for health where there's alcohol flowing and prominent in, you know, in the display of that. In fact, even just last year, I was at a conference where I was surprised that there were no non-alcoholic options. And even asking for a water, I had to go outside of the conference center. Like, it wasn't even really available there. And so there's still work to be done. But I scaled up my drinking during the pandemic, like so many people did. And prior to that, as I said, I was probably a 4 or 5 day a week drinker at that time. I lived in New York City and, you know, had a robust social life and was, you know, going out with coworkers frequently. I was single, so, you know, dating and that drinking, of course, playing a big role in that. And during the pandemic, so I got sober in June of 2021. So kind of on that,
congratulations,
in that second year of the pandemic. Thank you. And, you know, at that point, because of the isolation, because of the stress from the, you know, our changing environment and the winter, that winter from 2020 into 2021, I know for a lot of people was a really tough year, especially here in the Northeast, like in New York City, all the restaurants were closed. There was really like nothing going on. And at that point, I started drinking more like every day. And I started drinking earlier in the day. And that was something that I had never done before. And it scared the crap out of me. And I didn't last very long in that behavior because I recognized really quickly that I was going down a bad path. And that for so long, I had really been struggling with the way that I felt. I had severe anxiety and depression my entire adult life. I, at that point, had started experiencing a lot of physical symptoms. My liver enzymes were elevated. I was having full body hives. I was having a lot of digestive issues. And again, here I am, this health expert, and I share about this in the book, that I felt like I was living a double life. And I know I'm not alone in feeling that way, because there's a lot of high functioning people in this world who also drink really heavily. And what we do is we make the excuse that, well, you know, I still have my life together. I have this good job, or I have these degrees, or, you know, I haven't lost anything, and therefore I don't have to quit. And my experience is kind of on the extreme end. But now what I do with people in my program, which, as you mentioned, is called Functional Sobriety, I work with people with all different histories of alcohol, whether they just drink a couple times a week and they think that's enough to make them want to stop, or they're daily drinkers and they need a little bit more intensive type of support. This is a conversation that is for everyone. It's not just reserved for people who identify as having a problem or are everyday drinkers, that now the health benefits we're learning from alcohol elimination are reserved for everyone who want to receive that. So it's really this kind of larger conversation now, that it's not just going to Alcoholics Anonymous if you have a problem. It's, hey, this is something that's having an impact on your life, the way you feel, your mood, your mental health, your physical health. You can make a change to eliminate it.
Well, thank you for your candor. Do you feel like mm-hmm. you have to categorize yourself as an addict or an alcoholic? Or do you just say, I just don't want to drink anymore?
Well, I categorize myself as sober, which is still a term that, you know, some people feel comfortable using and others don't. One of the things that I talk about, even on the first few pages of the book, is trying to avoid having to put yourself into a box or find a label right. that works for you, because the stigma of using the word alcoholic keeps a lot of people either in or out of making a change. And so, you know, I think a lot of what people do when they're wondering if they have a problem or if they need to quit drinking is we Google, like, how do I know if I'm an alcoholic, or am right. I an alcoholic or not, right? Like, we're very hooked on that word mm-hmm. for whatever reason. And mm-hmm. it doesn't really matter, right? In my perspective, it doesn't really matter how you want to identify yourself. If that label helps you in some way, then by all means, please use it. But I also have found that it has kept a lot of people struggling, because they are afraid of using that label. They're afraid of what that might mean or how people might perceive them if they say that more openly. And the reality is, you're the one that gets to decide if you feel like you mm-hmm. want to make a change or not. It is a personal decision that we get to make for ourselves. And we don't ever have to be at a certain point to say that, you know, okay, once I get to this point, then I'm bad enough to stop.
Dr. Amen, Daniel Amen, obviously famous mm-hmm. Psychiatrist, right? Just psychiatrist mm-hmm. in Southern California. Mm-hmm. You know, he's pretty forthright about what alcohol, mm-hmm. marijuana, you know, all these things that are prescribed, right? Air quotes again. But mm-hmm. now, mm-hmm. obviously, marijuana is prescribed, and we have a state mm-hmm. where you still have to have a prescription. And he just talks about it. He goes, let's just look at the effects on the brain. So mm-hmm. look, I'm a very visual person. So when I start realizing the effects on my brain or my liver or my hippocampus, someplace in the brain that gives me thinking and clarity, then I would think some people, not that I'm here to shame or anybody, it's their personal choice, but I just want to make sure this mm-hmm. is what my big thing, like with COVID, just make sure people are informed when they make mm-hmm. their personal choice, because I love having personal choice. So let's talk about what it does to the brain.
Yeah. So there's a couple of different things that alcohol does to the brain. And one of the things that Dr. Amen talks about, there was a study in 2022 about, is how alcohol shrinks the brain size. So it shrinks the white right. matter and the gray matter of the brain. So it actually ages the brain more rapidly. Mm-hmm. So like, again, if we were using wine for anti-aging effects for the heart, it's right. still aging the brain, right? So this right. is, again, where we have to kind of analyze these different areas and really from a full body perspective, take mm-hmm. this into consideration. But what that does is when the size of the brain changes or when the quality of the brain changes, it affects how our brain fires, right? So it affects these different areas of the brain that control thinking and memory and cognition and focus. But one of the other things that I love talking about is the neurotransmitters. Mm-hmm. The neurotransmitters are things like serotonin and dopamine, our feel-good hormones. Also things like GABA, which is how mm-hmm. our brain and our nervous system relax. Well, alcohol does, you know, kind of cause temporary changes to these neurotransmitters. So something like dopamine gets a little bit of a boost when we have a drink for the short term, at least initially. But one of the other things that alcohol does, because it depletes nutrient status, it lowers most of the vitamins that we want and need, things like B vitamins that help with energy, but also help with things like mood. These vitamins, so B vitamins and many others like magnesium, zinc, et cetera, they all play a role in how we produce these neurotransmitters. So if we are drinking alcohol because we need a little bit more of a feel-good pick-me-up from dopamine, it's also lowering these important nutrients that actually help to naturally produce these neurotransmitters. So it's really giving us this kind of short-term fix, but creating all of these longer-term effects, right? Because I don't know about you, Lisa, I'm sure the people listening can relate to this, but even if alcohol has given me a short-term boost of feel-good, it's usually followed by not-so-good, right? And we think about that in the short term as a hangover, but those effects are carrying over for several days. And the more we drink, the worse we're going to feel from these effects.
Isn't it something like 72 hours? It's like the first round of, you know, metabolism and then up to 2 weeks, depending on, you know, what, oh, your the health of your gut and some other mm-hmm. things, you could really harbor that for a while.
Yeah. And even something like cortisol, which is our body's yeah. stress hormone, cortisol is increased when we drink alcohol. And even after having a couple of drinks, two drinks or more, cortisol increases take about 7 days in order to recover. So yeah. even if you're yeah. drinking once a week, you're having impacts to cortisol and how your body manages wow. stress. So again, it gives us this initial feeling like it's reducing stress, but it's actually over the long term worsening those stress hormones.
I come from mm-hmm. the functional medicine philosophy of mm-hmm. root cause. So let's see, mm-hmm. you know, what is firing yeah. the anxiety. And I know when I entered perimenopause, which are those years before the cessation of your menstrual period, which is, you know, one calendar year from your last menstrual period to your menopause. I was having heart palpitations. So I thought a glass of wine in the evenings, really, I was getting up about 3:45 in the morning because I was on the radio. So my evening was really 2 or 3 o'clock. And then because I ate by 5 o'clock or six, and then I was done because I need to be back in bed, start the day over. Mm-hmm. So
that's
let's
an
say
early morning girl.
Yeah, right. And I mean, I've done it. Media people, we're just used to having, you know, it's terrible. I mean, it's terrible for my cortisol. I mean, it was terrible for my health, really, mm-hmm. all those years I was doing media work. But whatever. I mean, I managed and all that. But what I now see is it never blanketed my anxiety. It never really made me, it never soothed me, but my brain still kept thinking until I realized and doing the study about bioidentical hormones and how important they are for the prevention of cardiovascular disease, dementia, a whole host of things, that once I got on bioidentical hormone replacement therapy, that's what soothed my anxiety. So the root cause was probably estrogen dominance is what we call that. That means when estrogen, progesterone, you know, are not at health, a good ratio, or maybe testosterone wasn't right. So, and then the deeper I studied, anyone who is taking bioidentical hormone replacement therapy, and I'm sure synthetic too, is then it, the alcohol travels down the estrone pathway. So there are three pathways, as you know. Not everyone listening understands that, but estrone is not the one. It's the Lincoln Tunnel mm-hmm. after an accident. It is not the route you want to take to get back to Newark or Jersey. Since we talked before we started recording that she's from New Jersey, and I told her I was born in Newark. So just to use that, estrone is a very serious pathway. Can you kind of address that alcohol, because people, they love to come to me as for a health coaching advice until we discuss their alcohol use, because it comes up. And then if they're mm-hmm. taking hormones, and then they're like, back off, lady. People get real defensive.
Well, yes, and I understand. It's a tricky topic, but it's an important one to talk about because it does play such an important role in all of these areas of our health. And so one of the things that I like to explain to people is that we know alcohol affects the liver, right? That's kind of one of the pretty well-known, not disputed, not argued areas of health.
Yeah. How's your liver? Shut up, liver. Right. It's Friday, blah, blah, blah.
Well, because I think people, we downplay the importance of the liver in other areas of the body, like hormone production or hormone right. balance and hormone right. metabolism. So what you're talking about here with the estrone pathway and the estrogen metabolism is basically the liver is needed in order to balance estrogen levels, balance estrogen metabolism from the body. And anytime we have alcohol in the system, what happens is we have prioritization. Alcohol is a toxic substance. The body recognizes it as this foreign toxin, and it is going to put a pause on everything else that the liver has to do in gotcha. Order to eliminate alcohol, right? So what it does is it takes all that hormone work that it needs to do, and it puts that to the side. So if we are consuming alcohol on a frequent basis, daily, almost daily, 3-4 times a week, that is going to be enough time that we're basically deprioritizing hormones more than 50% of the time, right? Wow. So what happens is we end up having a buildup of some of these these hormone metabolites. We have maybe a more sluggish liver in general because the liver is having to do a little bit of extra work on metabolizing the alcohol from the system. And so that is one of the mechanisms also by which alcohol increases risk for breast cancer, because when we have the buildup of some of these metabolites, these estrogen metabolites, they can kind of linger in the system and cause and create some damage. So that is why the liver is not just for things like alcohol. It's for metabolizing hormones. It's how we manage and metabolize cholesterol. So if you have cholesterol imbalances, high cholesterol, and you're a drinker, those two things might be related. And the liver does metabolize any other toxins or foreign matter from our body. So medications, if we take medications, yeah. that's also why alcohol is contraindicated, right? So it's important for us to think about the liver more globally than just its metabolism of alcohol.
Dare you call alcohol poison? Do you ever call it that?
Sometimes. Depends on who I'm talking to and the crowd I'm talking to. I mean, I like the word toxin. It's essentially poison. For those of you who don't know this, alcohol is considered a class one carcinogen. And this is essentially a list of substances that is known to cause cancer in humans, not a possible link to cancer. It is known to cause cancer. Right. Known. And I will share with you, for those of you who aren't familiar with this list, the class one carcinogen list, and you can Google this and get the information. But other things that are on this list include tobacco, asbestos, radiation, right? So these are things that we typically don't take in small amounts and say, like cigarettes, for example. We don't say, well, if you have one cigarette a day, it might be good for you, but any more than that is bad for you, right? No,
Right. A little radiation every day is good. You're fine.
A little radiation is fine, right?
Right.
And so it is a carcinogen. It's a toxin. It is known to cause cancer. And And I know that that's an extreme example for people, because most people are thinking, well, if I'm going to get cancer, it's probably far off. You know, there's other things that maybe are contributing to my cancer risk. But it's the other elements and things I talk about in the book, like the impacts to the gut, the impacts to hormones, the impacts to mood, to energy. These are things that are more day to day that we might be experiencing, and things that are maybe a little bit more short term that we're noticing. And so just know that even though that seems kind of like an extreme example, there are all of these other effects that are happening kind of on a day to day basis.
You remember when, like 20, 30 years ago, we started seeing images of the identical twins who maybe smoked, the one who did smoke and the one who didn't. Mm-hmm. And we all went, well, I was never a smoker, but I remember it probably was a deterrent for some people. And same thing with mm-hmm. the identical twins who were out in the sun. The one who wasn't mm-hmm. out in the sun, because I think sunscreen's carcinogenic, but because the sun is so valuable. You know what I mean? The extreme sunbather right. on the Jersey Shore, who's smoking and drinking. Right. Have we seen side by sides of the aging skin of the identical twins? The drinker and the non-drinker?
I don't think so, but I hope that we do in the future, because I do think that we're moving in the direction of tobacco. I think that the World Good. Health Organization is going to be moving in the direction and following suit of some of the success that we've had with limiting tobacco, because even something like having a warning label on a bottle of alcohol, it seems kind of like, and right now, technically, there are some warnings on alcohol. There's one that says, do not drink if you're pregnant, which is right. also interesting, right? If it's not good for a pregnant person or a baby, is it really good for the person?
Good point. Yeah.
Probably not. And not to operate machinery or to drive and to drink responsibly, right. whatever that might mean, right? But there isn't information. And here's where the public misinformation comes from, is we've created this health halo around alcohol. And we haven't really been forthcoming. Most people don't truly, truly don't know how harmful it is to the body. And for so long, we've gotten away with misleading people on this. But I really do feel like we're at the start of a movement where we're going to have to make changes to our society, because this is something that more and more research is showing that it's not truly not good for us.
This is one area where the West is not the poster child for something bad. Because when you go to Europe, girl, there is so much cigarette smoke in London right now as we're speaking, or mm-hmm. on the streets of Paris or in Italy, in mm-hmm. my favorite countries of the world. There is so much cigarette smoke that it's shocking that here in the U.S., I don't see people, except in designated areas outside the courthouse, mm-hmm. the hospital, you know, they're congregating. And now I even saw at our children's hospital, now they've even pushed that even further because it still wafts in the building and it's just, bleh. But Europe, it is, Europe are countries of smokers and obviously wine drinkers. And well, that's another story. But what do you think is the impetus? I mean, what will cause Europeans to finally give up the cigs?
They've done a lot of more abrasive approaches to limiting tobacco exposure there. For example, they've put, you know, if you've seen on the cigarette packs, they actually have images of lungs that have smoked for 30 years or a heart of okay. someone. So they have these kind of very graphic images okay. on the cigarette packs now. So they've taken some more extreme measures. That's not something the U.S. has done actually a better job than Europe has in reducing tobacco use. And I'm not sure how they'll continue pushing that forward. And it's a really interesting question, too, because cigarettes are very different than alcohol in that alcohol has establishments that are all based around the idea of drinking, bars. Right. Yes. So when they eliminated tobacco use from indoors, it just pushed everybody outside. But yeah. I don't know if we'll ever see a world where we eliminate bars because of the, you know, toxic nature of alcohol. I don't think we'll get there. So it'll be interesting to see the ways. I imagine things like warning labels and more public health campaigns like the truth campaigns around tobacco, for example, that would be helping people to educate people a little bit more rather than strict regulations.
What are some things you would recommend to somebody who's listening who she might be a couple of nights, you know, Friday and Saturday night, she's drinking. She does want to detox her liver. She wants to keep her gallbladder healthy. What are some health tips you can give her?
Yeah. So first and foremost, I mean, just even listening to this podcast, getting a little bit more informed around alcohol is really beneficial. I absolutely recommend checking out my book, How to Eat to Change How You Drink, because it is all about how you use food and nutrition, not only to support changing your relationship with alcohol, but also how to help heal the body from some of this long-term damage. So some of the foods that you can introduce that help to support the liver and rebalance hormones and help with detoxification are things like beets. I'm actually drinking a beet juice right here.
Oh yeah, I like those.
Because I typically am. Beets are really good for supporting liver health and detoxification. They're very rich in B vitamins. They help to enhance blood flow and oxygenation through the brain. But also things like cruciferous vegetables. So things like broccoli, cauliflower, cabbage, the dreaded kale. Those are things that can also help to upregulate and rebalance hormones, specifically in the liver. So that class of foods, the cruciferous, especially if you're focused on hormones, is one that I would suggest bringing in. The other kind of tools and things I talk about in the book are utilizing enhancing protein content throughout the day. Mm-hmm. Sometimes when we crave alcohol, especially at the end of a work day, the end of a stressful day, that 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock timeframe, sometimes it is the manifestation of low blood sugar. And I always suggest to people to think about when was the last time they had something to eat. If they have a strong craving for alcohol and it's that time of day, had they not eaten since lunchtime, 5 or 6 hours before, or maybe they had an afternoon snack that was really high in sugar and carbs. Mm-hmm. And now it is just simply that your blood sugar is low and that you're actually just hungry. And if you can have something to eat, an afternoon snack, or have your dinner a little bit earlier, could that be all that it takes in order to overcome an alcohol craving? So kind of getting involved in some of this information, reading some books, listening to some podcasts can be really helpful to kind of just get your brain thinking in this direction and know that there's a huge movement and support system around changing these alcohol behaviors. And if you're feeling called to do that, it's the perfect time to do it.
Well, now there's community. You know, we're saying, you know, in those blue zones, the other thing that helps with longevity is like-minded people who exhort, encourage. And now, you know, there are things that the World Wide Web does a good job of. And that's one thing, connecting people from different parts of the planet, but might have the same interest in homeschooling or hopping on one leg or whatever it is. And if it's, you know, sobriety, that's a great place to start. I guess some people, like, you know, you were kind of saying earlier, some people, we don't like labels sometimes. I think some people just want to say, I'm just choosing not to drink, because they don't want to put themselves in the corner to say, so are you curious? Are you sober or are you not? Well, it doesn't matter. I'm just not drinking tonight. I guess that's a way to help with the, if you do have the peer pressure of have a margarita, we're all out together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, community is huge. It's something I talk a lot about in the book. And it's part of the reason why programs like Alcoholics Anonymous, even though it is that kind of more extreme angle of people who are drinking more frequently, more often, part of the reason why it has been as beneficial and effective as it is because of its community aspect. Because you're bringing together people who wouldn't normally mix. You have connections with people who are like-minded, who share similar backgrounds, similar experiences. But nowadays, you don't have to go to Alcoholics Anonymous to find a community. So there are communities all over the internet, especially ones that are supportive to women. My group is called the Functional Sobriety Network, and it is essentially a place where we gather together and we talk about nutrition and wellness from a alcohol-free perspective. We talk about how this is a health journey, that this doesn't have to be something that is that you're doing because you have a quote-unquote problem. But there are many, many other communities out there, ones that are designed more toward mothers, ones that are designed more toward working women, ones that are more co-ed. And so finding a community like the Functional Sobriety Network or another is a really great place to start meeting other people that are like-minded, as you mentioned, Lisa, that are interested in the same topics and can kind of help and guide you and support you along the way. So highly, highly recommend that as part of your approach.
Where can they find the Functional Sobriety Network?
Functionalsobriety.com. You can learn more about the network. We have online courses.
All right,
we also have supplements and lots of good stuff there to support an alcohol-free or an alcohol-reduced lifestyle.
Great. I will put that in show notes. Okay. So give us options, because I have just stepped my way into loss of interest in alcohol, just loss of interest. I don't know. It's not a religious thing. It's not a social thing. It's not. I just don't want to do it anymore. But I do like fruity drinks with umbrellas. So name me two of your favorite mocktails.
So I actually have recipes in the book too. So
Get
the book, because there's lots of goodies in there. So I like some of the brands, the pre-made drinks. There's one that I love called Curious Elixirs.
Yes.
And they do a really great job of, if they're herbal, they are fruity, they're good. They kind of mimic other drinks. So they have a Negroni-like drink that is made with ashwagandha and some of these other beautiful herbs. They have a champagne-type cocktail. I love those. I think those are a great option. And I also, you know, I've also been talking to people a lot about different teas and how to get into, especially if you maybe are interested in wines and you like learning about wines and where they're from and the details. You can do a lot of that similarly with tea, because you can start exploring tea in a similar way that you'd connoisseur wine. So I always recommend bringing in new teas, trying different flavors. It's something that is relaxing, can kind of help take the edge off in a similar way that alcohol can, and can be a fun kind of exploratory thing to try.
You can put
an umbrella if you like.
Yes. Thank you. How has your life changed in the last 2 years for you?
My life has changed in every single way imaginable, which is why I talk about this publicly and openly, because I struggled my entire life with anxiety and mood issues. And, you know, I still experience those things from time to time in sobriety, but a lot of it is more stress related, situational. And I'm really grateful that I've learned new ways of coping outside of alcohol, because that's really the challenge that most of us experience, is we've never learned any other way to cope. Mm-hmm. And so when we take it away, it can be a little scary to learn new ways of coping. But one of the things that I share in the book and in my story is that some of the things that I wanted for years, like writing a book and starting a business and running a half marathon, within my first year of sobriety, I did all three of those things.
Right.
And I really believe that sobriety opened the door for me in so many ways. And I see this all the time with the people that I work with around the world, that it is this one thing that holds us back in so many different areas, physically, mentally, emotionally, relationships, job. And if we take that one thing away, even though it's kind of a big thing, it's a tough thing to think about, there is endless opportunity on the other side of it because of the ways that it holds us back.
Thank you for being here. And again, thank you for telling your story, because I bet there are a lot of women that can walk with you in your shoes. And thanks for paving a path for them. And thanks for doing this podcast.
Thank you, Lisa. Thanks for having me. So happy to be here today.
Thanks for listening to the Lisa Fisher Said podcast. If you would, leave a review and follow the show. This podcast is produced by ClantonCreative.com.